might be. How do you know what the right price
Yes.
is? And there's no answer to that. There are obviously many stocks at any time where one wouldn't know that what the price should be, only its relationship with stocks that you might know the price of. The gilt hedge market tended to move in price broadly together. But having said that, there were differentials within those various stocks. And if you knew the price of about three or four stocks, in fact, you could calculate very easily in your mind what the prices of the others should be. But also, it would only be over a continuing dealing in the market that you would know the positions, the jobbers' likely positions in stocks. There would be many, many occasions when you have no idea what their position was in the stock and whether they would might well wish to make sure you didn't know what it was. But merely by slight comments that they might make, one would be able to form a picture of whether they were short or long of a stock. And it was part of what I regarded as a broker's role to know. That does not say that one took advantage of it, but it was helpful in doing one's business.
I was very struck by the fact that it was regarded as not the right thing to do to be seen to be checking your price with the various jobbers, because in some ways that contradicts the conventional view of what a broker did in the stock exchange. The way the system worked was one did go and check with all the jobbers, and you found the best price, then you dealt with the best, who was most suited to you.
Well, the gilt hedge market is very different from the equity market. In the equity market, you have, I don't know how many stocks there were, but we're talking about thousands. In the gilt hedge market, at any one time, there were the market was broken in the government market, broken down between shorts and longs, and all my experience basically was in the long market. I didn't deal in to any great extent in the shorts. Only if we had a switch between longs and shorts would I deal. So I was only concerned with knowing the price of about 30 stocks. And so an equity dealer couldn't hope to know the price of all the stocks. And there is no relationship between one equity stock and another equity stock. There's no relationship between a textile company and an oil company, for instance. The oils may be going up and textiles may be going down, or vice versa. Whereas in the gilt hedge market, they're all the same, only different. And if interest rates are falling, the gilt hedge prices are going up, and vice versa. And so, as I say, if you knew the price of one or two stocks, then by definition, you had a shrewd idea of what the price of the other stocks was. And if, therefore, you had an order and you knew the situation in the market, you knew or should have known which jobber was going to be most likely to do your business. And you put your shirt on that. And there were many occasions when the chap who I was dealing for in the office, or even the client, would say, "What is the other jobber calling them?" And I would be forced to say, "I don't know, actually know what he's calling them." But it wouldn't have been in my interest to have found out, because by going and asking the other prices, I might well have prejudiced the ability to do the business with the jobber I'd chosen.
How would you react to someone saying that that doesn't sound like a very competitive market?
Well, it may sound like that, but if it is your business and you spend all day and every day doing it, it is part of the job to have the confidence and knowledge that you've got it right.
Mm. Now, is this the way
if you don't believe in it, then you'll go and ask the other jobber, yes.
Mm. Was this the way other broker-dealers were operating, or were there different styles?
Not many. I think there were other very good people in the Gilt Edge market and who I would respect, certainly. But maybe not all would have done it in the way that I saw it.
So how would they have done it? Would they have gone and chatted with most of the
people? Oh, yes. But there were not many other firms, if any other firms, the jobbers would have gone to sea to undo positions. I don't think there were any other firms to any extent, apart from Mullins, of course, in their role as government broker. Mm. And of course, Mullins, in their role as government broker, used to do switches for the market and undo positions for the market. And when the market was falling, Mullins, or the government broker, was the job of last resort in that he would buy stock from the market and frequently had to. And he would make a bid for that stock below the level of the market, and then immediately the market would fall to that new level. Mm. And that happened over the years on many occasions.
Now, how did the dealing side of Phillips and Drew develop? I know, looking at old lists of members, that the partnership of Phillips and Drew was constantly growing. I think by the early 80s there were about 50 or so partners. Did the dealing staff become a lot larger?
Yes, I think in towards or in the latter days in the 80s we had around 25 people in the house, and we would have had two people on the long dated gilt edge stocks, two on the short dated gilt edge stocks, we would have had two on debentures and fixed interest stocks, and the rest would have been in the equity market. And in the equity market, we would have had two or three partner dealers, and one of those dealt exclusively for Phillips and Drew's pension fund department, because we were one of the largest managers of pension funds money.
Mm. Were you in overall charge of the dealers in the house?
For some years I was, yes. First of all, Arthur Beard was the dealing partner. Then Paul Bazalgette, who joined at the same time as myself, was for some years. And then he subsequently became senior partner of Phillips and Drew. And when he became senior partner of Phillips and Drew, I became the partner in charge of the dealing side of, and then remained that until around about 85, and at that time I went on to the Stock Exchange Council. Mm. From the late 70s, I also managed gilt edge portfolios for the pension fund department, and so I played a lesser role in the dealing side, although I was still in charge of the dealing side of Phillips and Drew. And then in 86, I think, 1980, I went on to the Stock Exchange Council.
What did being in charge of the dealing side mean in practice? Did you keep a close eye on what your dealers were doing?
Well, one was responsible for the behaviour and of the dealing staff as a whole, for their salary structure and for the discipline in the house. And if something went wrong or there was a contretemps or row between one of the dealers and a firm, one had to try and sort that out. On the whole, that wasn't a problem. Dealers tend to sort out their own problems, and it's not a, don't often get to the stage where partners are brought into it.
How would you describe a typical day for you at the stage in your career when you were the dealer partner in charge? Would you be, well, when would you be leaving for the office, right through the different stages of the day?
Well, I seemed to get into the city latest when I started in the city, and it got ever earlier. But a normal day, I would get into... I can't say I was ever very good in the morning. People tended to leave me alone until about 10:30, but I used to get into the office about 20 minutes or half an hour before the market opened, and I'd go into the Phillips and Drew's office, and there would be a short discussion about the prospects for the day's business, and then 5 minutes before the market opened, I'd go down onto the floor of the house. And of course, there were many days when, for one reason or another, some traumatic bit of news or good news had come out, and the first half hour or so would be very hectic. And at those times, it was obviously very important to be able to attract the attention of one of the partners of the firm with whom you wish to deal, that is the jobber. Which was another good reason for being on good terms with them, in order that you attracted their attention and they dealt with you rather than with one of your competitors. There was no cue on the pitch as such. You just had to insinuate yourself in the right position at the right moment. Then the day would be spent. Many firms, Guildhead firms, operated from a box in the shell of the stock exchange. Phillips and Drew had a box, but it was used by the equity side of the firm, and I always stayed in the stock exchange itself. We had a telephone very near to the Gilt Edge market, well, within the Gilt Edge market, and we did all our communications from this phone, but I had no refuge. I could go out to a box, the equity box, but I always regarded it as a factor. If you're in a box outside the floor of the stock exchange and there's something happened, and when I say something happened, it one deal, if you're on the floor of the stock exchange, you'd see that deal taking place. You wouldn't know what it was, but if one of my competitors was on the pitch for more than 2 minutes talking to the same jobber, and they were obviously doing business, it was quite clear that there was something happening, and it's important to know that. So I was always on the floor of the stock exchange.
What would happen at lunches? Would you?
I'd go out to lunch, but hopefully that was a quiet time of day. The bulk of the business took place in the early morning, and then very often it tended to perk up a bit towards the close. The middle of the day was often quiet. Unless, in the old days, bank rate was changed on a Thursday at 11:45, and that could make Thursday a very busy day.
Can you remember the impact of any of the bank rate changes, or even in 67 when there was the devaluation, and I think bank rate went up 7 or 8%?
There were many situations along those lines. Days when... I think it was after the 1967 devaluation. On the following day, I did 45 different switches. Now, that doesn't sound a great deal, but believe me, I think it was the busiest day I ever had. And that would be in addition to a whole lot of straight orders. And there were days like that when it was very hectic and very difficult.
How would the jobbers react to a bank rate change? I mean, would they be fairly... would they simply adjust their prices, or would there be some frantic activity?
There were occasions. There was one occasion when the government adjusted the way that capital gains tax was levied on stocks according to the price at which they were issued. And this was known as the neutral zone situation. And there were some stocks which hitherto had been entirely the same. There was a British Electric 3s 1968-73 and British Transport 3s 1968-73s, and those two stocks had always been regarded as totally the same. But because of this quirk of the price at which they were issued, they became subject to a different tax situation. And immediately, the prices of the two stocks became 5 points different. Now, this was announced overnight, and it took the jobbers and everybody completely by surprise. And it took them some time to work out what the price of the new price of these stocks should be. And in fact, they had to stop dealing for a couple of hours to adjust that. There were one or two other occasions when dealings were stopped in order that the jobbers could readjust their prices and onto a new basis. And I think there was one day, it may have been after the 1967 devaluation, when we actually closed for a whole day.
Yes, I believe that.
But otherwise, there may, on occasions, have been a slight pause, and the jobbers would have said, right, just hang on, we'll start dealing again in 5 or 10 minutes. But otherwise, the market, to my knowledge, on the whole, never stopped, or it was always open.
Mm. Just reverting to your typical day, did you do a lot of dealing over the phone after the house had closed? Was that?
There was a certain amount of dealing after hours. It wasn't necessarily popular with jobbers because they, in the same way that I've explained, one could feel what the market was doing and knew what the prices were. The jobbers were the same, and they could judge whether the market was going down. When you're in your office, as we're sitting in this room, all hell can be breaking out down the corridor and we don't know about it. And that is, so the jobbers were less likely or willing to deal after hours, particularly in large amounts of stock, because they didn't know what was happening elsewhere.
Mm. And about what time of day would you be packing up, as it were?
Well, I suppose I might have tried to go home at 5 o'clock, but not before that. Mm. And there were many evenings, of course, when one stayed later, particularly if something was happening or something was in prospect the next day.
Did you find it a stressful life, or did you enjoy?
No, I enjoyed it enormously. Mm. There were times when, you know, one got tired. Because I was in the market all the time and didn't have some people, when sat in their box, I tended to stand in the market, and that on occasions was tiring, but I was always reasonably fit, so it wasn't a great problem.
Mm. Does the move from the old house to the new house in the early 70s via what's been called as the halfway house figure in your memory in any way?
The temporary market, as it was known, yes, it was not a very good time. It was I think there was a bit of a boomlet in the gilt edge market in 1972, and we had these rather cramped conditions with a low ceiling to the market, and the gilt edge market was in a sort of horseshoe. So in fact, Aykroyd and Smithers' pitch was out of sight, as far as I was concerned, from our telephone, and I know I didn't like that. It also coincided with Smith Brothers coming into the gilt edge market and starting up at that time, and that created a sort of destabilizing effect, in that we had a factor which we hadn't experienced before, and took a bit of getting used to.
Could you elaborate on that a little bit? Because I've heard a lot, even from the Smith partners, about the attempt to get into the gilts market.
Well, Smith Brothers were a very successful and good firm of jobbers in the equity market, and I think that the government broker had wished that there was another largish firm of jobbers in the gilt-edged market, and Smith Brothers therefore announced that they were coming into the gilt-edged market, and they quite rightly and sensibly sought the advice of a number of people before they came in and started up. And certainly my advice, for what it was worth, was that they should take it slowly and gain experience over a period of time before getting too adventurous. For reasons best known to themselves, they decided to be very aggressive when they started, and because of this, and because of the fact that they didn't realize that some stocks acted or reacted independently of other gilt-edged stocks, they were doing deals in stocks which, had they had the experience, they wouldn't have done. And I think this made it difficult for them, almost also made it difficult for the brokers, because it was an unknown factor. All of a sudden, we had this situation where prices were moving erratically in relation to one another, because Smith felt that they would move the gilt-edged the prices of stocks individually to some extent, and it was a very new factor and difficult to come to terms with.
Mm. What was the feeling when they decided to not to continue?
Well, we reverted to what we'd had before, and so we knew what we had before, and I think we were... I'm sorry that it didn't succeed, because I think they did try very hard in their own way. It was just that the gilt-edged market was something different to what they'd been used to, and didn't behave in the way that they expected.
It was more or less at the same time that Francis and Prey decided to cease trading, and also, I believe, a smaller firm called Pike and Brown.
Pike and Brown, yes. I was in Brittany on holiday, and I read in the Telegraph one morning that Francis and Prey and Pike and Brown packed up. And I quickly phoned up to find out what the hell was happening, but they were unrelated in cause. I think Pike and Brown decided that the business was not sufficiently good to warrant continuing, and they just ceased. Francis and Praed, I think, was a bit more surprising in one way and not surprising in another. They had had unfortunate circumstances at times, and I think hadn't brought on young people sufficiently to take over from the older generation.
Did it make a difference to the gilt market that Smith withdrew and the other two firms disappeared more or less at the same time, or had most of your business already been so oriented towards Weird and...
I don't think it made a great deal of difference to us. Mm. It was sad always to see anybody cease trading, but I don't think, as far as the competitiveness or the depth of the market, it made much difference. No. Mm.
Did the recession in 74 have an impact on the gilt market?
Yes, 1974 was when the equity market index went down to 146, and the gilt-edged market was in a pretty sorry state itself. And I think some wag said, well, if old consols go down as much as they have today, we've only got 18 days to go, because the price of old consols was then 18, and they'd just fallen a point that day. And things were pretty gloomy. Firms were losing money, and it did look as though the end of the world was at hand. But I think the saying, if you're going to go down fully invested, because after the New Year collapse of Burma, it's a bit of a mystery, but I've always felt myself that the institutions, perhaps at the instigation of the Bank of England, decided to put money into the market, and that's all it needed, because from about January the 2nd or 3rd, the gilt edge market and the equity market rose almost vertically. And all those who'd scrambled to get out in the later months of 1974 were quite unable to get their money back in again.
Mm.
And it was a very interesting time.
Were they particularly difficult dealing conditions? Was there still a lot of turnover in the gilt market?
Oh yes, there was very heavy turnover in the gilt edge market, and I can remember one situation at that time. We had a client who because of his, he was a overseas-based insurance company, and for tax reasons had sold or done a switch, and at the new year he'd sold a particular stock and bought another, and we had just before the market began to recover bought quite a large sum of stock, 15 million I think it was, of this particular stock, and then the market started to rise. And I particularly remember this because I went and asked the same jobber the price in 15 million of this particular stock. And he was quite convinced that we were, I've got it wrong, the market had continued to fall. Mm. And he was convinced that we were going to sell this stock back. And in fact, we bought another 15 million. And it was just as the market was turning, and but it was, it became very difficult to deal, particularly on the buying tack, because there was an acute shortage of stock. Mm.
Mm-hmm. Was this a time, in general terms, that broking firms found it difficult to make money during the 70s? The reason I ask is that a lot more matching business seemed to start to be done by broking firms during the 70s, and it's sometimes been said to me because the broking firms needed the double commission.
You're talking about the gilt edge market, or overall?
Overall.
Well, in 1974 it was a bad time for commissions because the low level of prices generated a low level of commission, and I think all firms found conditions difficult in 1974. In both areas of the market, I think in the equity market and in the gilt edge market, if the firm, broking firm, got a large order, there was the tendency and temptation to try and find matching business to undo that. And of course, if you carried to extremes, that was very bad news for the jobbing fraternity, because it destroyed their jobbing function. And it did become very difficult and a source of great aggravation in the equity market, and also to some extent in the gilt edge market, because of this matching of business. And in the gilt edge market, there were what were called net bargains. By netting a stock, the broker only took one position, one commission. Mm. And so it was possible to him to undo business. And by netting the stock, only to take this one commission, it enabled the client to get better terms. But it took away the jobbing function. Because the jobbers the stock didn't pass through the jobber's book. It effectively was done outside the market, mm. So the jobber just didn't get a turn on that. And the jobbers didn't like that, but it was quite a big factor and was a source of considerable aggravation at times.
About what proportion would have been matching business in the gilt market?
If you're talking about net business, I think not a large proportion. I would think something of the order of 5% mm. to 10% possibly. But very often the business was only transacted because the jobber did b- bought a stock and sold a stock. There may have been net bargains in the middle, but at the end of the day, the jobber bought a stock and sold a stock. Mm. And the business depended on what the jobber would buy and sell at, even though there were transactions in the middle. Mm. And so the jobber in the last resort did have the say-so as to whether that business took place.
Mm. Now, the later 70s were a period in which what have been called guilt strikes took place, particularly in 1976.
Yes.
What kind of time was that in terms of dealing? Was it a judgment that the brokers and jobbers made that yields were not sufficient to justify taking on stock, or was it something that a judgment that the clients were making?
I think it was a collective judgment. The market, the people, the professionals who dealt in the gilt-edged market felt that because of the government's borrowing requirement, and that they knew that at some stage the government had got to issue stock, and so it was a question at what price or what level of yields the broad spectrum of insurance companies and pension funds would be prepared to start to buy stock.